Hello, welcome to Seasteading Today. I'm Joe Quirk, and I talk to seasteaders and their supporters. I first learned about Tom W. Bell when I was seeking to understand the practical dynamics of polycentric law and startup cities, and I went straight to the expert, and I started reading Tom W. Bell's papers and watching his videos, and I thought, man, wouldn't it be great if this legal innovator became a seasteader? And soon after that, Tom reached out to us and has since become one of our most staunch Seastead advisors as we seek traction on our floating city project. And it's just been invaluable, Tom, and I thought the seasteading community should get to know you. Professor Tom W. Bell has earned his JD from the University of Chicago in 1993, and thereafter practiced law in Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C. He then served a stint as a policy director at the Cato Institute before joining the faculty of Chapman University, Fowler School of Law, where he teaches all of the first-year common law courses and many electives in high-tech IP law. Bell has published papers on copyright, internet law, polycentric law, prediction markets, and the Third Amendment, the one about quartering troops. Bell's books include Intellectual Privilege, Copyright, Common Law, and the Common Good, which was published by Mercatus in 2014, and the forthcoming book from Cambridge University Press in 2017, which is called Your Next Government. Through his consulting firm, Archimediate LLC, Bell advises companies developing special economic zones on the design, installation, and support of private legal systems. Tom, what got you interested in seasteading?
Well, as you noted, Joe, there's a lot of affinities between what seasteaders want and what I've been working on for much of my career, most notably creating new jurisdictions where people can try out new laws and new ways of living.
So why should seasteaders care about legal systems?
Well, everyone should care about legal systems, but seasteaders are in the enviable position, if they get some seasteads going, of being able to actually create new legal systems. And they should care about that because they're going to be living under those laws. They want to choose laws that will respect their rights and let them prosper, let them have economic growth.
And you've been helping us with that, and it's been really interesting to watch all these ideas get developed. And can you tell us, what is a C-zone?
A C-zone. So that's something that, together with people at the Seasteading Institute, we came up with as something like a cross between a seastead and a special economic zone. And that gives us a framework, a legal and regulatory framework that's already in place for SEZs, which we can adapt to the special needs of an aquatic environment. So basically the idea is to have a special economic zone, specially tailored for the ocean, that will work something like special economic zones, but hopefully better.
You know, and I think about how different Mexico is than, say, the United States. With just one line drawn straight down the middle, there's such a huge difference in well-being among people that live right next to each other. And you talk a lot about the rule of law in these different jurisdictions. So how important is the rule of law, and how does it work?
It's very important. In fact, the World Bank recently did a study of sources of wealth in the world. Very interesting study, and it turns out when you break apart their numbers, the biggest source of wealth in the world is not material things like cars or diamonds, it is the rule of law. That's a remarkable thing because it's almost as if wealth is being created out of thin air. If we can get institutions in place that ensure people's property rights are respected, that their contracts can be enforced, that the government doesn't get out of hand, they become wealthier very quickly. In fact, the World Bank quantified this. They said if you can improve systems of governance by one standard deviation, which is not a huge change. That's like the jump from, say, Portugal to Finland. You can improve annual incomes by 300% over time. It takes a few years. But if you can make that relatively simple change, you can make people very much more wealthy very quickly. And more wealth isn't just, you know, wearing bling. It saves lives. It's about making people in some of the worst off parts of the world very much better by giving them better rules.
And like humans need rules to live together. And when you see legal jurisdictions are the most important factor to human well-being, it's like the root of where everything else springs. And, you know, if monopolies are poor providers of service in other areas, isn't the worst place we can have a monopoly in the root of the production of laws? I mean, you talk a lot about nation states, and they actually haven't been around that law long. Like, is there a way we can improve the nation state?
Absolutely. And introducing competition is one of the main ways. That's what I really like. One of the things I really like about seasteading is once we get it going, and I think we will relatively soon, there's going to be a lot more competition for terrestrial sovereigns. And whether they like it or not, they're going to have to step up to the plate and get better. And even for people who say, oh, it's silly, I'm not interested in going out in the ocean, even those people's lives will get better because their governments will have to compete with these competitors right offshore.
And you wrote a great paper about this with the Foundation for Economic Freedom, I think, why competition among governments is important. And, you know, you run into this problem when you say competitive governance. People think government's competing. Doesn't that mean shooting and killing? and what are we talking about that's different?
Well, governments can compete that way, and they tend to do that more often when the citizens don't have a choice. They have to put up with the taxation and be conscripted and sent to war to die in the trenches. So governments do compete that way, but that's, of course, not what we're interested in. We want less of that. And the way to get less of that is to allow people freedom of exit from bad governments to better ones. That's part of it. And also by simply having enough competition so that governments that think it makes sense for them to tax for wars discover pretty quickly, that actually doesn't sell to our citizen customers, you might call them. Because people primarily like peace. They want to stay home and have barbecues and watch TV. They don't want to go shoot strangers. So we want to make sure that governments realize that's what people want. And if they don't satisfy that need, people say, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to go to someplace peaceful where the taxes are lower.
Yeah. And Hondurans want that too.
Yes.
And you've tried to do a lot of work there. And can you explain to us what a Honduran ZETE is? What is that program?
A ZETE, that's the Spanish acronym for a Zone of Economic Development and Employment. And I want to stress up front, this is something the Hondurans came up with on their own. It's very exciting. I think all the credit should go for the very far-seeing people in Honduras who have created through their ZED program sort of the prospect of super SEZs. Mm-hmm. So your typical SEZ, even the most robust and wide-ranging ones, they have residents and they have, you know, a different form of regulation, maybe lighter regulations than the rest of a country. But the Hondurans want to go farther than that. They want to create these special zones where, in effect, the people living there can import the laws from other countries and live under them to a larger degree, not to any degree. For example, the Hondurans are very sensitive to drug war concerns. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be able to create a new Amsterdam in Honduras. You're not going to be able to create a Zed where, you know, people can take heroin in the street. There's limits. And also they want to ensure, more importantly, that the Zetis in their jurisdiction protect human rights. Very concerned about that. But within those broad parameters, the Hondurans are saying, we want to invite people to try out different kinds of legal systems that will protect individual rights in Honduras and give our people jobs and create economic growth. And we'll have to see what works. But the fact the Hondurans are willing to give that a try is very promising.
And how do these ZETAs apply to seasteads?
Well, it's a great model for seasteads. The sea zones that we've been working on would basically take that Honduran model and put it in an aquatic environment. So you won't just get exemption from customs duties, which is all well and good, but it's basically the same legal system with one less, you know, of tax or fine. But instead, they'll be able to have a common law legal system in what is a civil law country. They actually wrote that into the statute. They want these ZETIs to use the common law. It's quite remarkable. It's a civil law system. There's a fundamental distinction in the law between civil law countries based on ultimately the Roman code from the Roman Empire and the common law countries such as England, America, Canada, New Zealand. And the Hondurans are said, you know, those other countries, those common law countries seem to work better, and empirical evidence suggests they're correct. So let's try that out in Honduras. And so a seastead could do the same thing. It could bring in laws that work better and try them out in small areas.
So the Hondurans are looking at these precedents for creating prosperity in special economic zones? And what are some of the concrete examples that people can look into?
They were inspired by Hong Kong. That's one example they cite. In fact, they've said, we want to create a Hong Kong in Central America. Yeah. And Hong Kong, of course, was founded as a British outpost in the 1840s in China and flourished under the common law. Effectively, English law was imported to that part of China. And the Chinese caught on to this. There are no fools. They looked over the fence from mainland China and saw that in Hong Kong, they had among the highest per capita incomes in the world. And at that time, China was nowhere near the top of world per capita incomes. And you know, they looked over the fence and said, what are they doing in Hong Kong that we're not doing? It's the same language, same ethnicity of the people, same climate. Everything's the same except what? Their systems of governance. And arguably, people worry about, China was going to take over Hong Kong. And certainly they have now established authority over Hong Kong. But really, in a way, Hong Kong took over China because the Chinese implemented through their really far-reaching special economic zones some of those same reforms on the mainland, and it's been a huge success.
Yeah, I remember George Gilter doesn't even get much credit for predicting, like, this is the year Hong Kong will take over China, which is quite a thing to say. And what fascinates me about this, it's like, so these different legal systems were evolving all over the world, and British common law emerged as the one that seemed to work best. If that's probably arguable, but if I measure it by places like Dubai saying maybe we can set off 110 acres and import this kind of common law here and bring in British judges complete with periwig toupees or whatever they're called, those white wigs, they're actually having those. It's such an interesting way of you can import different legal systems and just graft them onto your country in little places. And then it works. Mm-hmm. It creates unbelievable wealth.
Yeah, I'm glad, Joe, you brought Dubai. It's another example, maybe a better one than Hong Kong in a way, because you can look at Hong Kong and say, well, the British forced that down the Chinese throats. That didn't happen in Dubai. The people who founded Dubai, who created the International Financial Center there, basically, it was all voluntary. They said, we want this place to flourish. Nobody wants to invest a lot of money under Sharia law. Maybe we think they're wrong about that, but they're Westerners and they have their own notion of the rule of law and the rules they want to live under. What can we do to make them happy? And that's why they basically built into their legal code. They kind of imported, or you might say, they created a call to the English legal system to encourage investment in Dubai. And it worked. It really worked.
It's funny because it's almost like socially they said, okay, we want Sharia law. This is how we want to live. But we also want to do business with Westerners. And we're acknowledging we have different value systems. But we'll create a little island of... Is it a combination of these two things, or is it entirely common law from England? Or
it's not entirely common law. In fact, a lot of people mischaracterize Dubai. If you look at their legal code, actually, it's a common law of England and Wales, and it's actually at the bottom of the list. The top of the list is really the law chosen by the parties. So you can go to Dubai, and if you fill in all the forms and you become incorporated to do business there, you can choose the law of something other than England with people that you contract with. That takes preeminence over other provisions of law that might apply. And they have some other things in there like Dubai's local law. And at the very bottom, kind of as the default, if you don't pick any of these other options, then you go to the law of England and Wales. So I think it's interesting to kind of look at it from a marketing point of view, how often, and I do this too, but people point to Dubai and say, oh, they have English common law. Well, they do in a way. But I don't think that's really the reason for their success. I think rather it was this more general open-mindedness where they said, you can choose the law you like and it'll be okay in our jurisdiction. We will respect that. So that's even in a way more radical than them saying, we're going to import the common law, suck it up, or don't even show up here. Instead, they said, you get to choose your law. And that perhaps is the real secret to Dubai's success.
Now, our mutual friend, Michael Strong, education entrepreneur, very passionate about creating new legal systems in order to create prosperity for the poor. He has this great talk where he shows two slides like Dubai in 1990 and Dubai like 12 years later. I don't remember the years, but it's like a little desert place with a couple of buildings and then these towering skyscrapers in almost no time. Mm-hmm. And it almost looks photoshopped. Sometimes people in the audience ask if it is, and no, it's a real photograph. And I think a lot of Westerners look at that and say, oh, you see, this is what oil wealth creates. But oil, it's something like 4% of their economy or something. So what is responsible for this flowering of skyscrapers and wealth in this place that's very seemingly alien to many Westerners? Mm-hmm. Is it a new legal jurisdiction or is it something else?
Well, I'm going to give a lot of credit to the legal system. I think that is at least a necessary, if not sufficient, element. Necessary in that people needed reassurance if they were going to sink a lot of money into Dubai and do deals there that they would be enforceable, that the authorities in Dubai wouldn't change their mind and shut them down tomorrow, that their contracts would stand up in court. There were probably some other things as well. Maybe it's a good thing they brought in those judges with their robes and wigs for symbolic reasons, because that resonated with people and it gave them confidence that seeing words on paper alone would not give them that, oh, they're really serious about this. So there might be some stagecraft there. Governance is, you know, PR in some ways, and maybe the people in Dubai have that figured out. But certainly the laws were necessary. You can't rely solely on stagecraft. You got to have some real meat on that bone to make it work.
So you've got a book coming out from Cambridge University Press in 2017. And why do you call it Your Next Government?
Well, I actually, kind of funny, Joe, I actually want them to use a question mark in it, which they're not yet agreeing with me on. I want it to be Your Next Government? Question mark, because I don't want to pretend I know. The important thing is I think we're coming to a world where people will have more choice in governments. And they will be able to choose the governments that suit them best. They'll be able to consent to the ways to live together that they most want. And I can't predict really where that's going to go. The book will talk about some features I've already seen in other situations that suggest some of the features these successful governments will have. And I have my own ideas about what a successful government should do in terms of protecting human rights, property rights. But no one should pretend. So I basically see what's going on now as a quiet revolution. It's kind of this inside-out revolution going on now that people haven't noticed. Part of the book is to tell people, wake up. There's actually forms of government happening under our noses right now everywhere in the world that are transforming government. And that's going to be a trend we see more of, and it's going to change the sort of government that my readers live under. It's going to improve government, and I don't know exactly what the next governments will be like, but I'm pretty sure they're going to be better, and that's good news.
I really like the question mark because it stands out from other titles, because it gets to the root of our contention, which is it's election season is coming up, and everyone's arguing about what's the right way to, you know, rule each other. And our contention is we don't know, but we want to provide more choice among them and create competition in such a way that unpredictable things will emerge. And you talk about this, you suggested we can understand legal operating systems by looking at computer operating systems. And why is that?
So the fundamental idea is that code is code, whether it's a formal algorithm that makes a computer run a certain way or laws on the books that make people drive on the right side of the road, for example. So it's all code. But code in the computer context has developed much more rapidly than code in the legal context. And so I think we can kind of see the future in a way by looking in the computer context, looking there to see what's going on with operating systems. And basically what we've seen is a couple of interesting things. One is the development of operating systems that work across platforms, not just one operating system for this particular model of PC, but Windows for all types of PCs. And that actually was a big innovation. And we're not there yet in government. Still, right now, every state has basically a handcrafted legal system. And you get these terrible inefficiencies. You know, you go across the border from the United States, even to Canada, another common law jurisdiction, and things change. And you got to figure that out, and it's expensive. So that's part of it. But then, too, what's even more interesting, if you look at more recent trends in computer science, is the development of open source operating systems like Linux. And I've called for something similar in the legal context. I call it ULEX. It's an open source legal operating system. And again, because, I mean, if I get the question mark in the book's title, Your Next Government, it'll make clear I'm not sure things will work this way, but I can easily imagine a future where at least some of these C-zones will opt into this open source legal operating system, and that will give them uniformity across jurisdictions, so that'll make it easier for them to trade with each other and to have immigration from one C-zone to another. And it'll give them a freer, better legal system, just like Linux has many advantages over Microsoft, including that you can open the hood and tinker with it. These alternative legal systems would have the same feature. And that's just looking at the computer operating computer operating system context and saying, what happened there? Well, that's interesting. Could that happen in a political context? And I think so.
So what are some concrete examples of private governance that work better than the nation state?
The one that most Americans are familiar with is basically the sort of government you get out of homeowners associations, condominiums, cooperative residential communities. And in my book, I'll offer some numbers on this, but the short of it is those sorts of communities have been skyrocketing in popularity in recent decades. Something like 25% of Americans now live in a homeowners association or a condo or co-op. And people don't at first think of it this way, but I think with some explanation, they can see that those are actually forms of government. When you live in a homeowners association, it can be as large as a city. In fact, some of them are larger than cities. Columbia, Maryland is actually a homeowners association made up of homeowners associations, and it has over 100,000 people. Parks, roads, schools, stores, private police security, everything any city has, they provide privately through their homeowners association. And it's not just in Maryland, it's all over the country. So in America, what we see are basically people opting out of traditional political municipalities, like here in Oakland, and joining these kind of private governments for their private towns. They do it because they like it. You know, it's a good investment for them. So that's in America. We don't see in America as much, but we do see elsewhere in the world, and again, my book will have stats on this, the growth of special economic zones. Mm-hmm. So overseas, these have really taken off, especially in the developing world. Look at China. Millions upon millions of people now living in these special economic zones. Now, it's not exactly like a homeowners association, but you see internal immigration in China, so people are moving to Sichuan or wherever they need to go to find jobs in these special economic zones. And again, people are choosing the sorts of government that work for them. And it's not because there was a revolution, people waving flags, or an election. Mm-hmm. It's a much more subtle, slow, kind of undercover process.
Even at the basic level of selling goods on eBay, without necessarily changing your ideology, you're provided this option to choose, you know, private arbitration and private governance, and people just, you know, credit cards, all these things. People are just, it's like you don't need to, you know, at the Seasteading Institute, we say, stop arguing and start seasteading, because you don't need to win arguments if you can actually provide the better choices.
That's right.
And I think that's what we want to do with legal systems. And that's part of the problem we have with nation states, is that we don't have much choice among them. And I was listening to one of your talks, and I heard you say something that really stuck out for me, where you just said simply, the nation state is not a safe place to stay. what a funny thought, because we're all staying in nation states. And don't nation states protect us from murderers?
Well, I suppose sometimes they do, but they also create murderers, and they murder themselves. I mean, I've done the numbers on this, and it's a very close contest between the nation state in the 20th century and just your run-of-the-mill murderers in the street. Who has murdered more? Mm-hmm. It's a very close contest. But the thing is, that means nation states are quite deadly. They're dangerous. And when they work great. I mean, I'm sure many of us are pretty happy with living in the United States. Not perfect, but reasonably safe. But, you know, given the history of nation states, I can't be really sure America won't go south the way that so many other countries have. And elsewhere in the world, most people are living under much worse forms of government.
Right.
So we need to give them more options. We need to give Americans more options, too. In fact, I say of America, you know, I love and fear my country. One reason I'm interested in all this stuff overseas and on seasteads is to bring reform home. I want to make the United States a better place. And the way to do that, I think, is kind of tough love. Create competition so that young people in the United States, just as their forebears immigrated to the United States, might say to the United States, you know, it's not working for me here. I got the student debts. I can't get a job. I'm going to go to one of these new places. And that'll make America get better. It'll have to get better.
Yeah, and these things, states expand slowly. I read recently that this is the first year that the worth of goods confiscated by civil asset forfeiture has surpassed the worth of goods stolen by thieves. So it's usually not this sudden thing. It's just this creeping expansion of force into our lives. And so you write about consent theory, and another one of your talks that you gave in Russia, which was, I'm always amazed that he's such a receptive audience. You said, everybody agrees that we should agree on things. And I was like, that's such a simple statement. So how do we get that? I mean, how can consent, the idea of mutual agreement, help us find better options than the nation state model?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of consent, and I think it's actually, to wax philosophical, it's a transcendental argument for consent. And by that, I mean simply, it's a logical certainty. You say, if I'm trying to persuade you of something, I'm trying to win your consent. So it shows that we care about consent, the fact that we bother arguing with people. And so I think consent, if not the paramount virtue, is a feature we see in all types of ethical systems. Whether you're utilitarian or deontologist or a virtue ethicist, they all think consent is really important, as is evident in our day-to-day lives. I mean, we can look at kids on the playground and tell who's playing nicely and who's not. So consent's super important. I think we should try to get more of that in the political context. And my work has been in defining consent so that we can see it's not a binary thing. People tend to think about it as black or white, either consent or you don't. And in fact, the world's a much more complicated place, and that's a good thing. Because our political systems now, I mean, you live here in Oakland, and you probably think, you know, it's okay. No one asked me to sign on the dotted line, but I did move here. Did I consent to Oakland's municipal government? And I'd say, sort of. But if you moved from Oakland to a homeowners association where you really do sign on the dotted line, I'd say, you know, that homeowners association has a stronger, more consensual bond with you. And so what I'm picturing here is us climbing this ladder of consent, the sort of gold standard, what we want to have supplanting these very kind of pie-in-the-sky arguments about America, love it or leave it, so you did consent to have Hillary Clinton as a president. It's a very bad argument. Just because you didn't flee the country? We should look for institutions that can say, yeah, you signed on the dotted line. You had a free choice. Someone held a gun to your head. There were other options. You could have left to a seastead or to another country. But you signed on the dotted line. And then when that happens, I think we can say, wow, that's a more justified system of government than one where some strong man in power says, I control the borders and you're going nowhere, and I'm going to thereby claim that, you know, as in North Korea, you're my subjects. That's just a really bad form of argument. We can do better.
Yeah, and you talk about consent-rich societies is what you want to create. I love that phrase. And your academic work focuses on the theory of private legal systems, what you've called polycentric law. So it's interesting stuff, but does it work in practice?
Well, we actually already live in a very polycentric world. Once you open your eyes to that possibility, you see it everywhere. So, for example, you can have someone who's a practicing Jew who has certain dietary restrictions, therefore, who at the same time is the member of, say, a diamond trading firm where all contracts are resolved privately. Who at the same time is living in Massachusetts, living under state law and living under federal law. And then you have all these overlapping rules from public and private sources that govern one and the same person. It's really the world we live in. So we live in a polycentric world, and that's a good thing. And I think we should recognize that and then just try to foster more of that so that you'll have a choice between not just federal employment laws, but if you get your employees to agree, maybe some other better for you arrangement. So more polycentricity would give people more choice, which means more consent. And as you said, I want to see consent-rich societies. We'll never get to perfection. There'll always be some coercion going on, some bad stuff, but we can do better. So I'm looking for marginal improvement.
So what are the downsides to free trade zones, special economic zones, and all these special jurisdictions? Are they automatically going to be better, or are there other challenges?
Yeah, they don't always work. And in a way, we should celebrate that, because if there's no failure, people aren't trying hard enough. Just like when we see businesses fail here in Silicon Valley, in a way, that's a good thing. It shows the system works, because the ones who succeed, you know, they did something different. And SEZs sometimes fail because, it's usually because planners have done a bad job of planning. It happens all too often. They say, well, we want to bring, you know, more economic growth to Northern Africa, so we hired these experts, and they said we should build an SEZ here, and we're going to throw a bunch of money at it, and let's stand back and see the magic happen. Well, really, markets are a lot better than government planners in choosing where to have these developments. Another problem we see is sometimes they turn into gravy trains. You know, the SEC is really just a way for the powers that be to shovel money at their supporters. And so they give them juicy contracts to build the infrastructure, or provide the services. And it's not what the market wants, and it doesn't take off. We also see sometimes SECs drain away. They don't really create economic growth. What they do is they concentrate economic growth in a country in one place because they treat more favorably businesses in that zone. And all that does is kind of move the money around. So what you want to have to, it seems, looking at the evidence, people have studied this pretty carefully, is you tend to get better results when there's less central planning. Private parties both choose where to build the SEZ and they have to fund their own infrastructure, so no one's drawing that from taxpayers.
Right.
And they run the SEZs privately. They tend to do a better job. The evidence shows private parties, the World Bank is, you know, this is from World Bank stuff. They're pretty square, but they say privately run SEZs tend to work better than publicly run ones.
And this is why I'm interested in seasteading and see if you can tell me that it's this simple. The problem with getting SEZs going on lands within existing governments is you have to negotiate that with those governments that can change their mind at any times and can derange the natural thing we're trying to create. But if you can completely start over with a new jurisdiction, then they're much more likely to evolve to be positive things if people can choose among them and there's no tax loot you can give out to favored industries. Is the dichotomy that simple? Like if we could just start over and have a real startup city, say on a seastead, would it be virtually likely that it would be a positive thing?
I think that's a pretty safe bet. I'm willing to say that at least would be a positive thing. Now, that doesn't mean on net, seasteads are therefore more likely to succeed. Because why? Well, the way I think about it is basically you're incurring terrible costs to build the seastead. I mean, it's just really expensive. It's technically difficult and it's expensive to build a seastead, whereas dirt's already there. You just walk on it and build on it. So the cost there, that's like a huge, maybe the biggest downside. In addition to legal uncertainty, I mean, we're really not sure yet. This is the thing I love working on with the seasteaders. We're really not sure yet exactly how seasteads are going to interface with existing terrestrial governments. Mm-hmm. And there could be some problems there. So there's a lot of mysteries there. But on the upside, again, to emphasize the positive, as you said, the big win is you're not displacing anybody who's already there. You're creating land, so no one can say you took it away from this government, mm-hmm. and you have kind of a clean palette to try things out on. And I think if we have lots of these experiments going on, we're going to find some really great ways for people to live together peaceably and get prosperous and teach the rest of us how to run a government.
Yeah, founding society is consistent with the non-aggression principle. That would be very exciting. Mm-hmm. But suppose we create, 1,000 seasteads all over the oceans of the world and they're prospering. How can special economic zones like that help nations improve?
Well, in a couple of ways. One is, first of all, I should say, Joe, at the end of the day, honestly, I don't care about nations. I care about people. You know, if it doesn't help nations improve, but it helps the people in those nations, because they say, for example, I'm tired of Tajikistan. It sucks here. I'm going to leave and go to a seastead. Too bad for Tajikistan that they couldn't keep people happy. Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, I don't cry for Tajikistan if those people are getting better lives. That said, I do think in the long run, even existing nations will end up in a better place because they're going to learn from seasteads. You said we have 1,000 successful seasteads, and I hope so. But I hope so. I hope we also have some failures. And we can all stand back and look at that and say, what worked, what didn't, and now can we bring some of that home to Tajikistan or Panama or the United States? And hopefully we'll learn, when you give people more choice in government, when you're more sensitive to their needs, when you win their consent, it works better for everybody. And you don't have to be out in the middle of the ocean to implement those lessons. So even the people staying home, even if they think seasteaders are kooks, end of the day, I think their lives could get a lot better from that.
So if you were going to analyze the impact of a special jurisdiction, like a sea zone, for instance, what kind of data would you want to collect?
Lots of data that no one is collecting now. It's very frustrating. The World Bank has done some really stellar work with what data they can collect in assessing how well SEZs work. I don't think anybody's really done it right. What you need to do is, this is what I'd love to see done in Honduras. They haven't actually launched their ZDs yet. They're getting close to it. What you need to do is, first of all, kind of take a statistical snapshot of the country as it exists. And then once they create these special zones, keep track of how economic growth changes, both within the zones and without. And over time, this will allow you to compare not just zone territories with territory outside the zones, but also you'll be able to compare each zone to another zone. And so if you're going to do it right scientifically, you need to start before the program starts, collect lots of data about employment, immigration, construction, environmental impacts. It's a lot of work. But it's an important question. I really think somebody needs to throw a ton of money at this because we really need to figure this out, and we don't want to fly blind. And it's not very easy to come in after the fact and say, well, this SEZ was a big success. Even if there's tall buildings there, you can't be absolutely certain it was because of what they did in the SEZ. Maybe it was some other factor.
So, but if you create SEZs, like Shenzhen, for instance, and then tens of thousands of people vote with their feet, isn't that all we need to make an assertion?
Well, you know, I mean, that's good evidence. I mean, it really is probative of something, but it could be that they voted with their feet that way because governance got really bad very quickly in the other places, for example. Maybe actually it's not that much better than where they were, but the other places got much worse. Or it could be, and this is a concern with SEZs, they all flocked to that particular SEZ because the government threw a bunch of money at it. And they stopped funding infrastructure outside of the zone. And people need rail lines and pipelines and telecommunications. And so they said, well, I want to go where that is. Basically, the government scraped together all this money and threw it at their buddies in this zone, so I'm going to move there. And we don't want to replicate that model. So to make sure that's not what's going on, I think we have to be very careful about the data and not just look at the tall buildings and the jobs and say, our work here is done, it's a success. It's more complicated than that.
So is there any good empirical evidence about the public policy impact of these special jurisdictions, or are we flying blind?
I think we have good evidence. You know, whether it meets the highest standards that scientists demand, I'm pretty sure it doesn't. And that's okay. You know, that's the way government works. We are always wondering how good is this government versus that government. There's so many variables. It's hard to be certain.
Right.
I just mean to say that this is a chance for us really to run the kind of experiments that we need to run to get more solid answers. It's from not just from the point of view of, oh, we could change the world, make it a better place, but from kind of an egghead's social scientist point of view, it's very exciting because you have, when somebody sets up an SEZ, think of Honduras, they're going to try the common law system for the first time in this culture and region that's been civil law. Wow, that's a great natural experiment to see if we can credit common law systems their evident success to their legal system, or maybe it's something else. Maybe it's, you know, the English language. Who knows? This will give us a chance to find out. So academics should be super excited about this natural experiment.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely need more experiments than arguments. But are you able to nail down any special conditions that allow these zones to work better or worse?
Yes. And again, the World Bank has studied this, and it seems like there's a correlation between privately managed zones and greater success versus publicly managed ones. And also, when private parties basically determine where the zone will be located and what businesses will be sited there. There's something rather like that going on in the United States now through what are called free trade zones. Not many people know about these. They've been very successful in the United States, and it's not a top-down process. Basically, a municipality that's a port of entry goes to the FTZ board and says, we want to do this here. And you make application. The federal government does not say you need to put it here. You go to them and say, can I build it here? And they give you the thumbs up or thumbs down. And usually these are privately run zones, and it's been a big success. They're very narrow. I mean, they don't do what seasteaders want to do or even what the Hondurans want to do. They're very narrow. But in that small area, that's been a big success because why? The private sector has taken the lead in both choosing where the zones are and in managing them once they're built.
So, Tom, what do you think is the future of governance?
I basically have an optimistic view of things. The trend is good. I think we're seeing certainly less warfare. One of my favorite books on this count is Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature, mm-hmm. Wonderful book. And that shows you, I think, governments are getting better, even old-fashioned nation states. But I think looking even further down the road, the growth of special economic zones and homeowners associations, to me, these are the same phenomenon in different places and at different scales, are showing people are getting more and more options for more consent-rich communities to live in. And seasteads take this another step. We have a long way to go. There's still a lot of room for improvement. Seasteads will take us another step in that direction, and I think we're going to see even more of those good things, more prosperity. We live in the wealthiest time that humans have ever enjoyed. I see more of that. The most peaceful time humans have ever enjoyed, I see more of that. And consent and competition between jurisdictions is going to drive that.
So Tom, I'm really grateful for your counsel and your scholarship and your legal writing on behalf of all we're trying to negotiate here with our coastal countries. And thanks for listening at home. And we have some exciting podcasts in the can about approaching technologies for seasteading. Check us out at seasteading.org. Look at us at Facebook and Twitter. We post lots of interesting stuff there. Take a look at our floating city project. Thanks, Tom W. Bell, and thanks, Alexander Cosma, my partner in this podcast. And thank you all, our donors and our volunteers who keep this ship sailing. And I'll see you all on Free Seas someday.